From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
We wanted our children to be professionals. We wanted our children to be lawyers and doctors and school teachers. We wanted for our children what all people want for their children. And as we look at our children today, I have to say thank God that that may now become part of our reality.
The Manhattan District Attorney yesterday asked a judge to vacate convictions of the five young African-American men convicted of the famous Central Park jogger case. Today, a roundtable discussion as well as reactions from the mothers. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a historic motion, the Manhattan District Attorney has recommended this state dismiss all charges against the five young African-American and Latino men convicted in the famous Central Park jogger case over a decade ago. We'll have more on that story in just a minute. The New York Times is reporting the Bush administration is stepping up pressure on Hans Blix and the UN weapons inspectors to identify key Iraqi weapons scientists and take them out of Iraq. Then they would be offered asylum in exchange for disclosing where Baghdad is hiding weapons of mass destruction. According to U.S. and U.N. officials, some Bush administration officials even want the U.N. inspectors to kidnap Iraqi scientists and take them to another country against their will. Hans Blix is reportedly arguing the U.N. cannot abduct people. He has the backing of the United Nations and the State Department in Washington. High-level negotiations on the issue became visible when National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice met with Blix in New York on Monday and pressed the issue. The handling, debriefing, and resettlement of defectors is traditionally a function of intelligence agencies. Senior Iraqi officials have already begun to assail the inspections as a tool of U.S. intelligence and preparation for war. In 1999, it was revealed the CIA for 3 years infiltrated the U.N. inspections teams to spy on the Iraqi military without the knowledge of the United Nations. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports Bush administration officials are already preparing to declare Iraq in material breach of the UN Security Council resolution. Vice President Cheney, Secretary of State General Colin Powell, War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and others met yesterday to hash out the administration's response to the declaration Iraq is required to make this weekend on its nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. Administration officials plan to say they have evidence that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction despite its denials. Two peace activists are refusing to pay $30,000 in federal fines for traveling to Iraq to provide medicine there in violation of U.S. sanctions. Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness told the Oregonian newspaper, "We don't believe it's a crime to give medicine to needy people." She said giving money to the U.S. government is pretty repugnant to us right now. And a new report by the Congressional Research Service has found Henry Kissinger and other members of the new 911 investigation committee will be required to publicly identify any client who has paid them more than $5,000 for consulting work over the last 2 years. This according to anonymous congressional officials quoted in the Financial Times. Israeli troops killed 10 Palestinians overnight in a raid on the Baraj refugee camp in Gaza Strip. A UN official says 8 of the 10 people were civilians. The Palestinians died when dozens of Israeli tanks entered the camp, firing shells, spraying bullets from machine guns while helicopter gunships dropped bombs from above. The Israeli army said the operation had targeted Ayman Sheshnia, who the army described as a local militant leader. The AFP reports he's an activist with the People's Defense Committees of Yasser Arafat's Fatah movement. Troops were unable to find him, but they blew up his home. Venezuela's oil exports have ground to a halt as big business-backed opponents of President Hugo Chavez said they're extending a nationwide strike into a fifth day. Chavez ordered the armed forces to take over state vessels whose crews refused to operate them. Meanwhile, the Spanish government is admitting for the first time that fuel oil is leaking from the sunken tanker Prestige. The aging vessel split in two and sank off northwestern Spain over 2 weeks ago with around 60,000 tons of toxic heavy fuel aboard. Portugal is strengthening its anti-pollution measures as oil slicks from the tanker near the tiny fishing villages of the nation's northern coast for the first time. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
And good day to all of our listeners and viewers around the nation.
Well, it is a very significant day. We now turn to the decision that was handed down yesterday. Donald Trump had called for their execution. The New York Post described them as a teen wolf pack, and one New York police detective reportedly still refers to them as mutts. They're the Central Park Five African-American and Latino young men who were convicted a decade ago in the rape and near murder of a woman in Central Park. Yesterday, the state essentially admitted they'd convicted and jailed the wrong men. In a historic motion, the Manhattan District Attorney, Robert Morgenthau, asked a judge to vacate the convictions. The decision came in light of new evidence that showed the attack was carried out alone by a serial rapist named Matthias Reiss. Reiss admitted earlier this year he'd raped and nearly beat the woman to death on the night of April 19, 1989. DNA testing matched Reiss and no one else to the crime scene. New investigation by the DA's office has uncovered no biological or physical evidence that implicated anyone else.
The Central Park Five gave videotaped confessions, but their testimony was deeply flawed. At times, they were wrong on when, where, and how the attack took place. Nonetheless, two different juries convicted the men on a variety of charges, including attempted murder and rape. Cries from the family and defense attorneys that the young men's confessions were coerced by police were ignored. The case now goes forward to State Supreme Court Justice Charles Tejada. He will rule on the DA's recommendation by February. Defense attorneys have called for an expedited decision. At a press conference yesterday, the mothers of the Central Park Five assailed the New York Police Department for failing to properly investigate the crime, as well as the media for demonizing the innocent men.
We're going to play some of the responses of the mothers, beginning with Sharon Salam, who is the mother of Yusuf Salam.
Let me say, for all of us here today, this is a great beginning. Obviously, it is not the end we seek, but it puts us closer and closer to that end. When this incident first occurred in 1989, I had often said to myself, why can't people see what I'm saying, or see what I'm hearing, and see that this is false information? Why can't they see that a lot of the stuff is not real? Why can't they see beyond the veil? Obviously, for those of us who are parents and sisters and brothers and aunts and uncles who went through this experience along with our sons, we are truly moved by this decision. But we also feel that we have all been victimized just as the Central Park jogger and all those other people who were victimized that evening. We have all been denied justice. In our case, we were made examples of what goes wrong with the city. And that fueled the fire to whatever could happen to us, whatever could happen to our children. Now that a decision has come from the DA's office asking for the setting aside of the verdict, I don't know what that means or how we feel about it after going through all this struggle. I know for many of us, we feel very happy. For some of us, we feel very tearful. For some of us, we wish this had happened 13 years ago. Every day we woke up, we prayed to God, is this the day? Is this the day? But we had to wait 13 years for that day to come as we prayed, with people looking at us and calling us names, wondering what kind of children had we bore. We are in such a trying time and a trying place now. And I look at what is happening and what's coming out of this case, and I remember what Youssef had said to me on one of those occasions. He said to myself and Father Lucas, as a matter of fact, when we were up visiting him in prison, "Help the children." He saw something there behind those bars. And to him, it became part of why he was there. Obviously, as we lived our lives for the most part, our parents, our friends here, we weren't really engrossed into the prison industrial program. We really didn't know people who were incarcerated. So this was a new experience for all of us. And we're hoping as this experience comes to a close, that it is the kind of close that would lead toward total vindication for our children. I know many of you out there are afraid and unwilling to give up your suspicions of guilt. But it's now time to move on. When the police department and the sex crimes unit got this case, it was time for them to do their investigative work. Time for them to leave no stone unturned to find the guilty. But in their rush to judgment, innocent lives have been, well, I won't say ruined, but have been pushed aside. And our young people are waiting to reclaim their lives. Other people who were victims in that park that night also never received justice. Because many of those people, and I understand one of the witnesses said he knew who it was that attacked them, but no one went looking for that person. Everyone was eager to point the finger at these children. We are very pleased for this small victory, but we are hoping that with it, one day will come the total reversal of the conviction, the removal of our children's names from any DA, FBI, crime files, along with their photographs and other types of materials that relate to them. We are also hopeful that one day I can look my son and all these other mothers and sisters can look their sons in the face and know that they are not registered sexual predators. Our children deserve a chance to live their own life and to move forward with who they are. I don't know why Matias Reyes came forward, but I thank God whatever it is he found in prison, it was his time. Because obviously, just like I woke up every day asking God, "Is this the day?" And he said, "No." One day I woke up and I said, "Is this the day?" And he said, "This is it. We're moving forward this day. We're going to make a change this day. We're going to start the process this day." And as we move with that process, all of our children now bound together, even though they were strangers in the beginning, they were bound together through some mystery unknown to us to have this experience. Not of my choosing, and not of any of these other mothers and daughters choosing, because we wanted our children to be professionals. We wanted our children to be lawyers and doctors and school teachers. We wanted for our children what all people want for their children. And as we look at our children today, I have to say thank God that that may now become part of our reality. Thank God this is the beginning, and I look forward to the end.
Sharon Salam, mother of Youssef Salam, one of the five young men who were convicted in 1990, served up to 13 years in jail. Now, yesterday, the New York District Attorney recommended the vacating of all of their convictions. In the spring and summer of 1989, Matias Reyes raped, maimed, and murdered women until he was caught by running into the arms of a building porter on August 5, 1989. It turns out he had been identified months earlier in April as a suspect in a Central Park rape that took place 2 days before the jogger was struck down. No detective ever contacted or questioned him until civilians delivered him to the police. Even then, he was not asked about any attacks in Central Park. We are now going to turn to Angela Cuffey, who is the sister of Kevin Richardson.
First, I want to thank God for this day. You know, this is the day that the Lord has made for us. Well, I have to thank God first because it has been Him who has brought us this far. And He's never let go of us, you know. So through the years that my brother was in prison, all those years, 7 years he was in prison, and we continued to visit him and give him support and love. We always told him that God knows the truth. It doesn't matter what any man says. God knows the truth, and hold on to that. And it was our faith in God that kept us going. You know, I want to say to my mother, who could not be here because she's not well today, that we did it. You know, the truth has finally come out. Not based on any technicality, but on truth and justice, which is all we asked for day one. We just wanted the truth, and we wanted to be treated fairly and properly. We were misled, we were lied to, we were assaulted in the media. My brother's name was disgraced. He has his name back. You can't even begin to understand. My brother is the baby of four girls. He was the only man in our house, and he was given nothing but love. It was not even in his character to do anything to hurt another human being. And to see his name in a newspaper, that he was a wild animal, he couldn't go to high school. At 14, he tried to go to school when this case broke out. He was told he was not allowed in school. So from the age of 13, my brother was out of the school system. He grew up in prison. He grew up in prison. And, you know, we always had fears that he could be killed in prison, you know? Things like that happen. You know, when we went to visit him in prison, we felt like we were inmates. So it was a constant, all these years, feeling like we were victims as well. You know, the thing that always stays with me is that everybody should be outraged. Everybody. From the jogger herself, who we continue to pray for, as well as all the other victims and every other citizen in this city. We should be outraged because instead of the policemen in the DA's office continuing to pursue the actual rapist, they were more interested in prosecuting this false case. Mateus Reyes was allowed to rape and murder another woman. Aren't you outraged? Don't you want to change? It's time for a change. If nothing else, if my brother's experience serves as a tool for this city or as an example of this city as what not to allow to happen again, change the laws. You know, never let this happen again.
And that was Angela Cuffey, the sister of Kevin Richardson. We'll come back to the other mothers in just a minute here on Democracy Now!
Life, I wonder, will it take me under? I don't know. Imagine smoking weed in the street without cops harassing. Imagine going to court with no trial. Lifestyle cruising blue Bahama waters. No welfare supporters. More conscious of the way we raise our daughters. Days are shorter, nights are colder. Feeling like life is over. These snakes strike like a cobra. The world's hot, my son got knocked. Evidently, it's elementary. They want us all gone eventually. Trooping out of state for a plate. Knowledge, if coke was cooked without the garbage, we'd all have the top dollars. Imagine everybody flashing. Fashion, designer clothes. Lacing your click up with diamond rolls. Your people holding dough, no parole, no rubbers. Going raw, imagine law with no undercovers. Just some thoughts for the mind. I take a glimpse into time. Watch the blimp read, the world is mine.
If I rule the world,
imagine.
imagine that.
I free all my sons. I love them, baby. Black diamonds and pearls.
Could it be, if you could be mine, we both shine.
Nas, If I Rule the World, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And we're talking today about the stunning decision by District Attorney Robert Morgenthau of Manhattan yesterday to vacate all charges in the infamous Central Park Jagger case of 1989. And we've been listening to some of the relatives of the young men whose convictions have been overturned in a press conference they held yesterday. We're going now to Joanne Santana, who is the sister of Raymond Santana, the only one of the five men who is still in jail.
I want to thank God for what has happened today, for justice. All the supporters for supporting us through the years. Miss Helen, Mr. Alambe, that's not here. No, we lost our mother during this, and she's not here, but I know her soul. She's watching, and I know she's happy up there. And you guys know that my brother's in jail right now, and we want him home as soon as possible. And I want to say to my baby brother that I know he's watching, I love you, baby brother. I love you, baby brother, and we're here. We always believed in you. Thank God for this day. It's not over. What we went through, our family, from the community hiding, we don't want this to happen to any other children.
Joanne Santana, the older sister of Raymond Santana, who remains in jail, and it's why the attorneys are calling for an expedited decision by the judge.
Right. Well, Raymond had actually served, I think it was 7 or 8 years in jail, but then he was on parole when police came to his house about a week before the end of his parole, went in without a warrant, searched the apartment, found, they claimed, some drugs, and then resentenced him, convicted him on that crime, and also then he had to serve out the rest of his parole time as well.
And so if the judge vacates the convictions, they are hoping he will be released immediately from jail. We turn now to Linda McCrae, whose son was Antron McCrae. He was convicted as a juvenile of first-degree rape and robbery in the Central Park Jobber case.
I'm so emotional right now. So many emotions running through me. It's been such a long time. And to really breathe, I mean, to really take a deep breath and breathe and don't have to go back under. You don't know how how good that feels to breathe again. To be able to tell my son, baby, it's okay. It's all right. We can walk. You know, we don't have to worry about somebody whispering in the corners. This is what we had to live with. Oh, would this person speak to me once they find out who I am? But y'all made it so easy for them. Y'all made it so easy. We cried out so many times to y'all. But it seemed like nobody wanted to hear it. If it wasn't, yes, them boys did it. If I didn't have saying that my son was away at one time, oh, yo, nobody want to hear it. My only child, never been in jail. Lost so much. But you know what? I'm going to thank God today because he gave me that victory. He gave me the victory to say, I am free. My son is free. These teenage boys that was there 13 years is finally free. And maybe, yo, let them live. to become the men that they want to be fathers that they want to be, to guide their kids so they don't have to go through what they went through. Listen to me. Give them that chance. Let them live like you let everyone else live that lied on us, that didn't want to, that didn't want to step up to the plate. No, give them that chance now. Now go ask them why that they wait so long to come to us. Ask them. But I have no hatred. I have none. I don't want none. I had enough of pain, tears, sleepless nights. But let me say this out of all, I was never ashamed of my son. Never. Because I always knew he was innocent.
That was Linda McCrae, the mother of Antron McCrae. And we're going to turn now to Dolores Wise, the mother of Carrie Wise, who was released in August of this year after serving 11 and a half years. He served the most time. He was convicted as an adult, the only one of the five convicted as an adult, of first-degree sexual assault, first-degree assault, and first-degree riot.
But I didn't give birth to no rapists. And I knew my son wasn't that. He was so innocent, so he wanted to be a cop, a minister, and he wanted to be a police officer. That's what he used to say. And I used to teach him. Corey never traveled really far by himself. You know, everywhere I went, he went. That particular day that the jogger was supposed to have been being hurt, my son was saving a 16-year-old boy from jumping off the terrace over us from committing suicide. And we had the SWAT teams in our home, but they wouldn't come and help us either. I was shocked, devastated, because I asked my son, I said, come with me to my job to get my check. I worked for the state of New York. I took care of mentally retarded children, gave all the love that I had. On Saturdays, I worked in the synagogue, and I worked with the little Jewish children. I went to the Shabbat, danced around the Torah, and I gave them all the love that I had. So I had love. So my son knew what love was. I taught him that if anybody ever harmed him, go to the police. They're the best person to go to. And he believed that. And he trusted them. You know, yesteryear, I was so bitter. I was angry with the system. But I'm not. That's just the way it goes. I'm not even happy about today. You took that from me. Last night, I looked at Carrie. In the hell did y'all give me? I have a son that's been in jail since he was 16, but his mentality was like a 9-year-old kid. I don't know him. That jail raised my son up. He's 30 years old. He is so institutionalized. I can't even imagine to tell you the things that's going on. He doesn't even realize what's going on today. He don't care. Guess what? Why should he? He's still on parole. I cannot sit here today and tell you all that I'm happy, that I thank you. Y'all, the media, y'all did a job on us in 89, 90. 91, 90, I mean, y'all did a job. Just calling my son a rapist in Central Park was not enough. He just went through our families, caused my husband to drink, and he died. My son wasn't allowed to go to his father's funeral. They told me I had to put up $3,000 to pay for the workers to bring him down in shackles. So I said, forget it. Then when I lost my son, they still wouldn't bring him down. So my son never said goodbye. 7 hours going to Attica, you know, taking a 16-year-old son and putting him in a prison with men. He didn't get a chance to see the youth house. I would accept that. Crumbs is better than nothing. But to teach me and him a lesson, you sent him to Attica. And there he did his time. I thank God for watching over him. I didn't know that young man for the hours that I spent each month to see him, but I was able to be his mother and buy that horrible food out the machine and put it in the microwave and set the table. And I would say grace. Then we'll play cards or a game called Trouble. You know, God's time is not like ours. All it was meant to be. My son is not angry with nobody. He doesn't know how to be. You know, whatever y'all gave us or whatever the system did to us, we took that licking and we kept on taking. I am a tough mom. I just didn't know how to cry until today. And the reason why I'm crying, because I'm not happy. Because tomorrow this will happen again to 5 other youth. And 5 other moms got to go through what I'm going through. And this needs to stop. I thank God for the DA, Ryan, and Peter. I don't know them. I never met them. But I thank them for being honest and fair, because I'm not used to being honest and fair from you guys. Y'all don't play fair. Letterer, I pray that if she has children, you know, they say what comes around goes around. And I don't wish that on her. Fairstein, you ain't fair. You created this whole mess. Set it on your stage. Pick your judge that wasn't selected in the lotto. And you ragged us down. But we set it up strong. And that was because we had a mighty God to bring us through. And you know what? I could sit here as a woman, a godly woman, a mom, a friend. I just met these people. We didn't know each other in 89. Our children didn't know each other in 89. They all met in court. We all met in court. That's the grand finale. The children didn't know each other.
And that was Dolores Wise, the mother of Carrie Wise, who served the longest time in prison, released just this last summer.
The DA's report said that the convicted youth's videotaped and written confession strongly swayed two juries that had heard almost no other evidence. But the report went on. They were actually so full of discrepancies, those confessions, and errors regarding the rape, even about where, when, and how it took place, and who was involved, as to make the statements implausible as evidence. Barry Scheck, together with Peter Neufeld, co-founded and directs the Innocence Project at Cardozo School of Law. The Innocence Project has used DNA testing to overturn hundreds of convictions across the country and liberate unjustly incarcerated people. He has consulted with the defense attorneys on this case, and he also spoke at yesterday's news conference. We're going to hear a little bit of what Scheck said.
And then, Juan, after we hear from Barry Scheck, we'll be joined by New York City Council member Bill Perkins talking about a bill that he has introduced. Sharon Salam, the mother of Yusuf, joins us in the studio. We'll also hear the words of William Kunstler, who tried to represent Yusuf Salam through his daughter, Emily. And finally, we're going to look back at a case that many have compared to this one, and it is the Scottsboro Boys. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to DNA expert Barry Scheck.
This is a really important historical moment in the history of the criminal justice system of this city and this country because of the unbelievable attention that this case generated when it occurred. And as Councilman Perkins said at the very beginning, now is the time to move forward with some reforms that can make sure that what happened to these young men never happens to people like them again. and there is a very simple solution. It is time that we have videotaping of all custodial interrogations.
Please repeat that legislation.
It is time that we have mandatory videotaping of all custodial interrogations. This reform not only protects the innocent, it helps apprehend the guilty. Make no mistake about it. Matthias Reyes committed a rape on April 17, 1989, two blocks away from where this terrible crime occurred, in Central Park. He went on to commit three other rape robberies and a rape murder. From the district attorney's report, we now know that police had his name, identified him as having perhaps been the assailant in that April 17th case. Now, when you get false confessions from 14, 15, and 16-year-olds, it diverts your attention. You can't do ordinarily sound police work, and the real assailant escapes to commit more crimes. Peter Neufeld and I have this Innocence Project right here in New York City, Cardozo Law School. And when Judge Tejeda vacates these convictions and dismisses these indictments, we will then have 122 post-conviction DNA exonerations in the United States. In over 25% of these cases, there have been false confessions or admissions. In so many of these cases, there have been people like Matthias Reyes, serial offenders who were not apprehended because the wrong people were in jail and in some instances put on death row. Now, Mr. Morgenthau, Nancy Ryan, Peter Casolaro, the people who came forward and did this remarkable reinvestigation must be commended for pursuing with honor and professionalism what must have been a very, very difficult thing to do. And now it's time for them, I hope, and the New York City Police Department and people of good faith in the criminal justice system all across this country to undertake a reform that we know works in Minnesota. Talk to the prosecutors there. Talk to the police. It's a reform that doesn't handcuff the police. They can interrogate bad cop, good cop. They can do everything Sipowicz does that's good on NYPD Blue. The camera is surreptitious. It makes a record. We know what Elizabeth Lederer did when she interviewed these young men 28 hours after their detention, but we do not know what went on in the most crucial and important times when these young men and their family members were being interrogated and these false confessions arose. And that's what had to be videotaped. And that's what will work. That's what will protect the innocent and help apprehend the guilty. And that's what should come out of this case.
That was lawyer Barry Scheck of the Innocence Project at yesterday's press conference when shortly after Manhattan District Attorney Robert Morgenthau's stunning announcement that he was seeking to vacate all of the convictions in the Central Park jogger case of 1989. We're joined now by Councilman Bill Perkins of East Harlem, who has been working with the families for quite a long time now, and who's also introduced a bill in City Council over this very issue of videotaping all interrogations by the police.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting me, and especially for keeping this matter in the forefront of your listening audience. This case has revealed quite a few problems within our criminal justice system, one in particular that we've already submitted legislation on in September 25th, relates to the videotaping of the confessions. That was a key component in the convictions that convinced the jurors, and unfortunately, it was false confessions. And the legislation that we're submitting, as Barry Scheck suggested, is legislation that will require the police to start videotaping at the moment of their interrogation, not at the moment of the confession. This is a piece of legislation that is not new. It is presently being implemented, as was earlier mentioned, in Minnesota, Texas, Alaska, and Prince George County. They videotape all suspects involved in an investigation of major crimes. I think that in New York City, this will go a long way towards addressing some of the concerns about injustice, as it will begin to give people a greater confidence as to how these particular confessions were acquired. It protects the police, it protects the suspects, and most importantly, it protects the community, it protects the city in terms of the integrity of the confessions that are being used in these very, very serious cases.
And what are its chances of passing?
Well, you know, there's going to be a struggle like everything else because we have a relatively conservative criminal justice system, a very influential police. They're not automatically on board with it at this point. However, within the city council, we do have some significant support. I've had some conversations with the chairperson of the public safety committee where it has been assigned, Peter Vallone Jr., and he has guaranteed me that we'll at least have a hearing soon on the bill. I think the overturning of the convictions that we are celebrating to some extent, it will add some momentum to the realization that this is a very, very important reform that the police need to implement.
Well, Bill Perkins, I want to thank you very much for being with us, city council member. When we come back from break, Sharon Salam joins us live. Emily Kunstler will read some of the words of her father as he attempted to represent Sharon's son, Yusuf Salam. And we're going to go back in time to the Scottsboro Boys. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, our guest, Sharon Salam, mother of Yusuf Salam, and Emily Kunstler, daughter of William Kunstler, who tried to represent Yusuf Salam in court. Before we go to Emily, Sharon, your conversations with your son last night, Yusuf, mm-hmm. after the Manhattan DA recommended vacating all of the convictions.
Well, he's still a little apprehensive because, you know, until they are vacated, he wonders if they really will be vacated, as so the other children who are involved in this situation. But we are hopeful that these particular convictions will be vacated. Right now, he still has to register as a sexual predator every 3 months. Corey Wise is still reporting to parole. And as a part of the parole process, there's a fee that goes along with that that you have to pay to the parole people to be out on parole. And right now he's looking for employment. You know, it's like a whole number of things that need to be addressed among the children in general.
Hasn't Yusuf been writing for the Amsterdam News?
Has well,
he
written no.
anything? Oh,
I wish he had.
Something.
No. That's another gentleman, Yusuf Salam, by the same name. You see, that's really a very famous name. And when I selected it for Yusuf, I knew he would obviously be a very famous person.
We wanted to go back in time for a minute. Emily Kunstler works with us here at Democracy Now!, and it's great to see you at the table here, Emily.
Thank you.
You've got your father's book, the famed lawyer, late lawyer, William Kunstler. The name of the book?
It's a, my life as a radical lawyer.
So you've been going back through its pages.
Well, I was curious recently to go back and see what he had written about it, to see if it, because I thought that he would so much want to be a part of what's going on now. So it was very interesting to me to go back and revisit some of his old writings.
Why don't you read some of his words?
Youssef had his rights violated from the beginning. I thought what the authorities did to this 15-year-old boy was outrageous. He did not confess, either in writing or on videotape. That was the only tangible evidence against him, was his oral admission, which he supposedly made to a detective. I appealed Youssef's conviction all the way up to New York's highest court, the Court of Appeals. On December 16, 1993, the court affirmed his conviction 5-1, rejecting my argument that the police wrongly isolated him from his family, friends, and friends while they elicited his confession. This confession was the only evidence that connected Youssef to the crime. In his dissent, which received little attention from the press, Judge Vito Tatone said, "There was no justification for the authorities' actions in preventing defendant from gaining access to the helpful counsel of supportive adults who had gathered to assist him." That was the main point of my argument. The Court of Appeals ruling showed its racial bias. Had Youssef been white with a middle-class family, his police interrogation would have no doubt been stopped by knowledgeable parents or available attorney. Instead, his mother, aunt, and big brother were kept away from him. Judge Tatone, I was pleased to see, also noted that the police lied to Youssef during his questioning when they told him first that they had taken his fingerprints from the victim's clothing, and second, that he might be released if he answered their questions correctly. The right person, a parent, a lawyer, or another responsible adult, might have prevented Youssef from making any such statements to the police without an attorney present. Finally, Judge Tatone characterized Youssef's isolation and separation from his family and friends by authorities as an undisguised intention to exploit the defendant's youthful vulnerability. It is outrageous that Youssef's questioning occurred the way it did. He was only 15, and his constitutional rights were completely ignored. The judicial system of New York State has done to Youssef what some years ago in the South would have been done with a rope or a rifle. I am not surprised at the Court of Appeals' decision, because the court's role is to maintain social order. Keeping Youssef and as many blacks as possible in prison is a part of the function of the judiciary.
One of the interesting things that I had forgotten about was, Sharon Salam, I'd like to ask you about this, is that Bill Kunstler was actually held in contempt by the judge in this case. Apparently, mm-hmm. at one point, when he was initially defending your son, and he was, could you tell us about that? And he called the judge a disgrace to the bench, and the judge held him in contempt and tried to disbar him.
That's right. And he told me if he went to jail, I had to come and stay with him. But I did try. But you know, he was very passionate about this situation and passionate about Youssef and the other children, too. He saw wrong, and he wanted to right it. And he wanted to stand up and try to right it in whatever way possible, do whatever it was he had to do. Because it was interesting when he saw me sitting there in the hallway every day, and he would come up and speak, and we'd talk there for a little while. And he'd offer us, you know, a word of solace, just having someone to talk to who was really believing what it is you had to say. Because at that point, we were in the process of trying to convince everybody of Youssef's innocence. You know, it was, you know, really something. He's wonderful, wonderful man.
Well, you know, those of us who have seen him, who saw him in action over the years, he actually mm-hmm. represented me once many years ago. Mm-hmm. We're sure that if he had been there actually throughout the trial, he might have had a different impact on the jury then because of the power of a counselor as whenever he was in a courtroom.
Well, he may have, but you never will know in this case. Because one thing I do remember from Father Lucas, he did say at one point that Jesus couldn't have won it. When the fix is in, it's very difficult to win the case. And this case had been set up and constructed to assist people from the very beginning. They had the three elements they needed in place. The media, they had already convinced the public, which was the second element, and they had already selected the judge. So all they needed next was the hangman's noose. Mm-hmm. Everything moved as planned.
Well, Newsday's reporting this could be the largest multi-defendant case ever overturned on faulty confessions. Again, the Manhattan DA has recommended the vacating of all convictions.
Right.
We're still waiting to hear what the judge will say. Well, the Central Park jogger case has become one of the most famous miscarriages of justice in the country of all time. In our last few minutes, we're going to remember another case, one over 70 years old. It's the famous Scottsboro case, and we're joined right now by Robin Kelly, who is a professor of history at New York University and author of several books, including Freedom Dream, The Black Radical Imagination, and Hammer and Hoe, Alabama Communists During the Great Depression. Robin Kelly, can you talk about the Scottsboro Nine and how it relates to today?
Sure. In a nutshell, the case involved nine young men between ages 12 and 17 who were falsely accused of raping two white women in a freight train in Alabama in 1931. There were three different trials. There was no rape actually occurred. And in fact, in the second trial, one of the victims recanted her testimony and said there was no rape. Despite that, they were convicted. The final Scottsboro defendant was released in 1950. This is 19 years after the initial arrests, and the remaining were released about between 1938 and the mid-40s. There's so many similarities. I mean, and there's so many.
But they were all sentenced to death originally. Most of
them. They were all sentenced to death. Absolutely, and three times, three different juries. I think the third trial involved a judge who boldly said this case is ridiculous. You know, in any case, they were convicted. Their convictions were never overturned. Actually, the final person was exonerated in 1976, long after the case.
What do you mean exonerated? If they weren't overturned.
In other words, not exonerated. He'd gotten a pardon, basically a pardon from the governor of Alabama.
Huh.
You know, which was basically an admission that a miscarriage of justice had occurred. What's interesting about the Scottsboro case and where it compares, aside from the fact that you have again young black men railroaded for crimes they didn't commit, was the media's response. I mean, it's an interesting comparison because what made 1931 different was you had the presence of a radical movement, the Communist Party, that made this case not a local case but an international case. It turned a case of accused rape into a story of the barbarism of the South, you know? And you had massive protests in Moscow, in Paris, all out in New York, Seattle, L.A., defending the Scottsboro Nine. In this case, social movement made a difference for the Central Park Five. And yet the media's response immediately, like the mainstream media's response to the Scottsboro case, was to call them animals, you know, to portray them as violent, brutal rapists, with basically no evidence. What I also think is striking about this case and that case is that the mothers of the victims, and by victims I mean the defendants, played a key role in making this happen. You know, I just feel so honored to be sitting, next to Yusuf Salam's mother, Sharon Salam, and hearing her eloquent speech about this case, because this is exactly what Ada Wright did in the 1930s, and other mothers who really put this case at the forefront and were very eloquent and articulate about this injustice.
For the record, the nine young men, the Scottsboro Nine, Charlie Weems, Ozzie Powell, Clarence Norris, Alan Montgomery, Willie Robertson, Howard, Hayward Patterson, Andy and Roy Wright, Eugene Williams, pulled off a train arrested March 25th, 1931.
And I would be remiss if I didn't say something about the role of the mass media in this, because, of course, my newspaper, the Daily News, has been in the forefront of the campaign to continue. In fact, even as Morgenthau was releasing his report, we had a news story in yesterday's Daily News about supposedly calling into question Matthias Reyes's confession because someone in jail supposedly heard him say that he attacked the jogger after a group of young men had already done it. Now, anybody who has dealt with the prison system, with criminal trials, and with informants knows that for a case like this, there probably has been a long line of men in prison hoping to reduce their sentences by coming up with evidence to dispel the case. And, of course, the difference between Matias Reyes's coming forward is that he has nothing to gain. He will never get out of jail based on the crimes that he's already committed, so that he cannot expect a reduction in sentence. He's serving 33 and a third years to life. And whereas someone who's convicted of a lesser crime is in jail would have a lot to benefit from suddenly remembering a conversation with Matias Reyes. We apparently, some of our colleagues in the media have displayed an amazing frenzy to continue to prosecute this case.
Mm-hmm. And it's still going on today. And even with this decision, this is why I said the kids were kind of skeptical. You know, we are pleased, but we just don't know. Because when this case went down and the people who had been assaulted in the park, the police had put out this call, so a lot of people came forward. And the kids were accused of everything that happened in the park that night. And while they were being accused, the people who were the victims never identified anyone in a lineup. One particular witness stated that he could recognize the person. The police never looked for this person. The forensic evidence never matched anyone. No hair, no blood, nothing. They knew this from the very beginning. This was a situation where actually the police were wilding on us.
That's right.
They created this scenario, and once they had locked themselves into it, they didn't know which way to go to let it loose, so they just ran with it.
But the one man who remained on the loose was Matias Reyes.
That's right.
And he went on to rape and kill.
That's right. That's right. That's right. And unfortunately, many of the people, some of the people, whoever it was other person said they could recognize is out there as well and probably will never be caught because the police weren't looking for him. This was a story they put together just like Yusuf's confession. The detective said he wrote it 2 weeks later in the DA's office. He typed it up and he presented it to the judge, and the judge said, okay, that's the third element you need in place, the judge. He said this was Yusuf's confession. He said he remembered stuff, and he just added that in. So it wasn't even part of any statement.
But this confession was missing one thing.
It was missing Yusuf's signature. And more importantly, it was really missing Detective McKenna's signature because he was the one who wrote it.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us again. The final step is the judge deciding whether to vacate all the convictions. We'll stay
on
the story.
That's the final one.
Sharon Salam, mother of Yusuf Salam, Robin Kelly, professor at New York University. Thank you for joining us. That does it for today's program. And by the way, Phil Berrigan remains at home at Jonah House in Baltimore, surrounded by the love of his family and community as he lays dying of cancer. You are listening to Democracy Now!, our website, www.democracynow.org. You can get a copy of a video or audio of today's program, 1-800-881-2359, 800-881-2359. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf, Mike DeFilippo, and Rich Kim, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!